Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. Jazza, would you say you have trouble concentrating?
What?
Do you have trouble concentrating?
Oh, yeah, sorry, I wasn't... That was a joke.
Is this the standard of humour that we can offer to our listeners?
Well, they should.
Pretending not
they
to
should.
Be paying attention.
They should know now. Yes, I do struggle to pay attention.
I think there's ample evidence of that over the course of our podcast, to be fair.
Yeah, actually, when I was diagnosed with ADHD, I just submitted about 100 episodes of The Right Dishonourable, and that was that, really.
I imagine that most of your psychological evaluations could be achieved by doing that, to be fair.
Oh, yeah, the schizophrenia diagnosis is just coming through. I shouldn't joke about that. That's not funny. Jimmy, don't make jokes like that.
You're the one who said it, and you're supposed to be the woke one on this podcast.
So, I try.
We meet to discuss politics, current affairs, social issues, all of that good stuff. Every so often is the schedule.
Sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes it happens. And as listeners may have guessed who've been paying attention to the news for the last couple of weeks, one of the topics that we are going to be covering, the last actually in this episode, but it made for the most fun opener, so I went with it, is the BBC's investigation into ADHD. And in particular, so BBC journalist went to a bunch of private ADHD or psychological clinics to obtain an ADHD diagnosis. And he was able to do that very easily and very quickly. The allegation is that the tests that were applied weren't particularly rigorous, and that quite quickly after that he was offered medication, a prescription, without there being adequate checks. And then he went to an NHS doctor and had a 3-hour psychological evaluation, which came to the conclusion that he didn't have ADHD. And this BBC investigation came out in the form of a documentary a couple of weeks ago now. It's caused a bit of a furore online, I think it's fair to say, Jazza.
Yeah, well, this has come after we've seen, certainly an increase in the awareness of ADHD, and especially because of stuff like TikTok. There's, like, ADHD TikTok is, like, a big social phenomenon, and lots of people who are self-diagnosing based on experiences that people talk about on TikTok. I think it is... Just to do a little spoiler for this story, I think that it is possible that these clinics are bad actors, and that more people are getting diagnosed with ADHD because there's more awareness of ADHD rather than them not having it. Hot take.
I think I'm inclined to agree with your hot take, but I guess we need to thrash out the details for about 10 to 15 minutes in order to make a segment out of it. So listeners can wait until the end of the podcast to get our full thoughts on that.
Well, you're always so good at teasing our segments, Jimmy.
I think so. Yeah, I think we, you know, show a bit of ankle, but not too much.
Oh, no. My God.
Yeah.
Go on, give us the next two. Pull down the top, show us a bit of delicatage.
I was going to say, speaking of old-fashioned references, the Conservatives, both with a small C and a big C, have organised and run two conferences.
That is the Conservative Party of the United Kingdom, and social, I guess, or political conservatives who are not necessarily aligned specifically to the Conservative Party.
Well, I think a lot of them are not just not necessarily aligned, but in some respects actively opposed to the Tory Party.
Yeah.
As we'll probably call them quite a lot for clarity in this podcast. But various conservatives of shapes, all shapes and sizes held two conferences, Jazza, over the past couple of weeks. When we were discussing this topic, Jazza was under the impression there was only one Tory conference.
Yeah, I was only aware of the National Conservative Conference that Jacob Rees-Mogg and Suella Braverman and Tim Stanley and lots of lovely people spoke at.
To be fair, I think the National Conservative one got a lot more traction, partly because it was in London, and the Conservative Democratic Organisation conference happened down in Bournemouth the weekend beforehand.
Understandable, and who wants to go there?
But, you know, it was a great opportunity for journalists to attend one or both conferences as they would like and do think pieces on, you know, the future of the Tory Party, which is, to be fair, roughly what we're going to do here, I think, minus the actual attendance of the conferences. Because in summary, The CDO was nicknamed the Bring Back Boris Conference. So various people there who would quite like Boris Johnson to have another stint as Prime Minister. Boris Johnson himself didn't turn up.
Yeah, it went really well last time, so
yeah,
why not?
Yeah. And the National Conservative Conference, which I think was just a more ragtag bunch of conservatives of various different views. You know, some people that wanted people to have more babies, some people that wanted to pursue a neoliberal agenda economically.
Well, it was batshit, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think some of it was interesting. Some of it was crazy, but I like the crazy stuff. The crazy stuff makes for good podcasts. Possibly not a good way to run a country, as Liz Truss showed to us, but good podcast fodder, which is really what we're all about, Jazza.
Yeah, exactly. If you're here for your actual news, what are you doing, you idiot? We're here to entertain you. Lightly.
Well, you know, we're running a little bit behind time, I think, in terms of, you know, newsworthiness. So, but, you know, slow news is a thing. I think it's a more relaxing way to follow current events.
Yeah.
So speaking of things that are not relaxing at all, Jazza, do you want to tell us a little bit about Ron DeSantis and his candidacy to become president of the United States?
Yeah, Ron DeSantis is the current governor of Florida, has been since 2019. Is on the Trump side of the Republican Party, nevertheless has decided to formally tell everybody that he is going to run for president and therefore go up against Donald Trump, who is going to be running for his second term in office, running for president for the third time, and Ron DeSantis is a terrible person, I think it's safe to say, who has really positioned himself as like war on woke kind of stuff. There's a load of he's basically introduced a similar law to what we used to have in the UK called Section 28, which means that you can't talk about any gender, sexuality or relationships with anyone under the age of 10 or something like that, and that's being extended to up to 17, and it's a terribly worded law, and it's meant that people have been investigated for showing Disney movies to children. He's also had a long-standing feud with the Disney parks that are obviously based in Florida and are a big employer in the state. But the hilarious thing, and we love a little bit of schadenfreude, is that he tried to launch it with Elon Musk on Twitter Spaces, which is basically it's a bit of a overhang from when everybody was locked up in their rooms during the pandemic, and 500,000 people were on the stream and it crashed the stream, and so there was like a half hour where everybody was just going, can you hear me? Hello? Can you hear me? And that's how Ron DeSantis decided to launch his bid for presidency. And I think it's really he's interesting because he's basically positioning himself as, hi, I'm Donald Trump, but without all of the grab the pussy bullshit, and with the like, I've actually done stuff, I've passed legislation in Florida, I am, yes, the hot air, I position myself culturally in a similar position to Donald Trump, but I get shit done, essentially. He's Trump without the drama. But at the moment, he's only on about 20%, whereas Donald Trump is on 50. Oh, no. So we'll talk about him.
It sounds as though you're really looking forward to it.
Yeah. Shall we?
Yeah, let's play a little bit of music, talk about the Patreon account, and get on with the main episode.
Doop, doopy, doop, doop, doop. Hello, my loves. Jazza here. So, you may have noticed we don't have ads. Nobody wants to pay for them on this podcast. Oh dear, but how do we keep this beautiful podcast ship going? Well, we rely on beautiful, generous listeners like you to support us every episode on Patreon. Yes, that's every episode. You don't have to pay every month because we know that we are inconsistent. we like to, when we give the Patreon a shout out, just thank the members that we already have. And there's a few more of you now, which is really cool. Thank you so much to Archie, Ubel, Wilhelmina, Alice, Michael, Nick, Taha, Theo, Ilona, Seb, Marlene, Nick, Jer, Alexander, David, Andrew, Michael, David, Dermot, John, Agatha, who else? Ollie, Matt, Gemma, Dominique, Nat, Paula, and Philip. We really appreciate the support that you have given us. If you would like to join them, help us keep this going, if you appreciate what we're making, then go over to patreon.com and search for Right Dishonourable. Right, on with the show then.
So, Jazza, I don't think anyone has picked this up, but CDO, or Conservative Democratic Organisation, has the same initials as collateralized debt obligation. Do you know what that is?
No.
It's a financial term that it includes.
This better be going somewhere, Jimmy Nichols, I swear to God.
So it includes the kind of dodgy financial instruments, like that, you know, the recutting of subprime mortgages that led to the financial crash in the late noughties, if you remember that.
Nice, yeah. And do you think that there is a symbology at play here?
I just think if, you know, somebody had commissioned me to write an article about, you know, not mentioning any names, I could have opened with that, and I think it would have been very compelling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with a bit of finessing. You know, I mean, I guess it's, you know, you have to explain to people what a subprime mortgage is, potentially, which is always a little bit sort of...
Yeah, you wouldn't get past me if I were your editor, mate, I'll be honest.
But, I mean, effectively what it is bundling up a load of old shit that nobody wants to buy and presenting it as new and interesting.
Well, it's sales, and... isn't it? Oh, there you go. Well, now I understand. Yeah. That is a long walk to a punchline, though.
I think it could be a little bit snappier. I think once you're in there, I think the jokes write themselves, really. So,
wow.
So this is the conference, the Conservative Democratic Organisation, widely termed the Bring Back Boris Conference, in all of the press that I read about it, which is what it says on the tin if you go by the nickname. It was apparently a collection of various people who, I think Nadine Dorris was speaking there, for example.
Legend.
who thought that Boris Johnson had been hard done by, that he'd been stabbed in the back by... I mean, his own party, I suppose, for one. Various other people, the Blob, I guess, the civil service.
Sure.
And they're really keen to bring Boris back. Do you think this is a good idea?
What planet are they on? Like, even... So, he is still very popular among the Conservative Party base, but also we need to consider the Conservative Party is a tiny, unrepresentative slither of the electorate. The Tory party members think that he broke lockdown rules, and I believe they also believe that he was wrong to do so. It's whether or not, like, he should be punished for it and stuff is where there is divergence. But I don't understand. Like, he's not that popular. It's not like trying to bring back like an Obama or I don't know who's like a popular
Tony.
Well, he ended up not popular, didn't he? But never lost an election. I don't understand what this obsession is, but it's correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like it's because they all owe their careers to him, don't they? And the Conservative Party in Parliament at the moment is still Boris Johnson's intake. Like, it's the 2019 intake, the election campaign that he ran. And so everybody, to a certain extent, on the Tory benches in Parliament at the moment still owes their careers to Boris Johnson. I assume it's overhangs of loyalty there, no?
That's not entirely the impression I got. I mean, I think there's some of that going on, but I just think there's more than that. Because there's a bunch of the 2019 intake that have abandoned Boris Johnson for one reason or another.
Mm-hmm.
And so, some of whom have decided to step down at the next general election, don't really have skin in the game.
Yeah.
Anymore.
I mean, a lot of his old cabinet, like Dominic Raab, Priti Patel, are all not continuing to stand as members of parliament.
I don't realise Priti Patel.
I think Priti Patel. Actually. Let me. You continue filling space with noise, and I'll see if that's actually true. Hold on.
Well, Dominic Raab has definitely announced he's going to stand down, and you know, some of that is because the Tory party is polling so badly at the moment that it looks like a lot of them would lose their seats anyway, and I guess they just don't fancy fighting another general election with the prospect of a likely loss.
Yeah, they don't want to have the Michael Portillo effect, right? That is, I feel like that's like seared into the minds of all conservatives.
Yeah. So have you found out yet if Priti Patel is
standing down? No, keep filling space.
Well, she was actually one of the speakers at the CDO conference, which was chaired by this guy, Lord Cruddas, who I guess is a Boris Johnson loyalist. And yeah, I think it was supposed to be, I mean, a lot of people there denied that it was actually an effort to bring Boris Johnson back, but that apparently was the organising principle behind it, is that, you know, it would be a good thing to bring Boris Johnson back.
Mm-hmm. Priti Patel is not stepping down, by the way, but Nadine Dorries, Matt Hancock, Sajid Javid, and Dominic Raab have all said that they're going to stand down.
I mean, I think in the case of Matt Hancock, I don't imagine that he is encouraging of Boris Johnson's future career in politics, put it that way.
Perhaps not.
Given how it ended. Mm. So I actually think it was the much less interesting of the two conferences. It sort of seemed like a bit of a sideshow compared to the National Conservative Conference,
mm-hmm.
Which I gather that you actually, you know, given that you knew it existed, you spent a lot more time looking into the National Conservative Conference.
Yeah.
What did you make of it in general?
I really don't know. Oh, I can hear. Hold on. Are you still there?
No, I'm still here.
I'm getting a load of crackling. Hold on. Can you hear that? What is that noise? Was it clapping? Have I played a? What is happening?
Man's out.
Oh, now you're... Can you speak to me?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
I think my mic was doing something funny, but I've just unplugged it and replugged it in.
Look at you, good job. Okay.
So I was just asking your impression of the National Conservative Conference.
It was so interesting watching it because it had the attitude of a group of people who haven't been aligned with those in power for the last 13 years. Yeah, the National Conservatives are I think they are representative of the extreme, the right of the Conservative Party, right? Like, I think that there are a lot more members of Parliament who represent their views, Suella Braverman, Kemi Badenoch, and those kinds of individuals who are representative of kind of like this nationalism this nasty nationalism and exclusive nationalism that I think runs through the Conservative Party at the moment. And I think is really a post Cameron and May phenomena that we have had post Brexit, really. And
so
just so interesting to have people who are literally, who have the ear of the most powerful people in the country, who are actually making decisions, whose political party generally of choice is in power and has been in power for over a decade, and them all saying how shit everything is. And I'm like, well, whose bloody point is it? And there's so many things that they're invoking, like talking about God, talking about like trans issues, talking about like ethnic nationalism in really odd ways that I don't think you really hear anywhere else in politics at the moment. It just felt very, very detached.
the god thing is very interesting, I think.
And the god and the king thing as well, like, was, because this was just off the back of the coronation, right? And they kept on talking about how great it was, but also how it should have gone further and should have been fancier. And I'm like, he's literally in a gold carriage.
Well, King Charles made great play of the fact that it was a slightly stripped down coronation. So
I think slightly is doing a lot of work there, Jimmy, I'll be honest with you.
Maybe. So the background to the National Conservatism Conference is that it's effectively been ported over from America.
And Australia as well is kind of like where there's a big chapter.
Yeah. So Australia's got it. I think there was one in Hungary as well in the last couple of years. So, and this is the second or third National Conservatism Conference that's been held in the UK, but it's the first one that's got any significant press attention. I think because the likes of Suella Braverman and a couple of other...
Jacob
Rees-Mogg was there. Michael Gove actually spoke there as well, although he wasn't particularly well aligned to most of the people in the room, being a fairly liberal kind of conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're right. It's largely people who are to the right of the Tory party. And I mean, to be fair to their, so their general attitude is that they don't particularly like the Tory party. And as you said, with the coronation thing, the general view is that on any particular issue, the Tories don't go far enough to the right. In terms of their policy and their stance.
Mm-hmm.
I think in their defence, you know, so the Tories have been 13 years in office now, since the 2010 general election.
Mm-hmm.
The first part of that was obviously with David Cameron and George Osborne at the helm, who I think... So you've obviously got the austerity policy, which is economically, I think you could say that's to the right, but... In general terms, they were quite socially liberal guys, I think it's fair to say. I mean, George Osborne.
We had
now.
Gay marriage, even though the majority of the Conservative MPs voted against it.
But, yeah.
That was brought forward by a Conservative Lib government. But
yeah.
Let's not give them too much credit for that, stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying it was a, you know, compared to politics in general, it was a particularly left-wing government. But in Tory party terms, it was to the left of the Tory party on quite a few things.
Yeah.
I mean, Theresa May, I think, is probably centre-right in the Tory context, mm-hmm. I would say. And then Boris Johnson is kind of all over the place. And Liz Truss is obviously a sort of...
Nut job.
You know, economically liberal.
Oh, sure,
lunatic.
Economically liberal, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, let the markets rip, basically. So liberalism in its old sense of don't have too much government interference, mm-hmm. basically. And actually, given that some of the things that Jacob Rees-Mogg said about free markets, I think that it's fair to say that the free marketeers in the room, they've actually been allowed to have a go, basically, under Liz Truss. And we saw how that all went down at the end of last year.
No, but Jimmy, haven't you been paying attention? She just didn't, her policies didn't have a chance to come to fruition. Like, that was all of the turbulence was priced in. She didn't have a true go at the crack of the whip, you know?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, if that's what they want to say. I'm sure a lot, you know, I mean, Liz Truss kind of said that herself she gave a speech or wrote an article. She wrote
did
an article
something.
For someone, didn't
yeah.
she? Yeah.
I think it was in the Times.
We all found it very funny.
Yeah.
But it's
a similar thing hearing all of these people talk. They claim to be speaking for what England, and I think it really is, this is a very English conference, I feel.
Sure.
Yeah. It is speaking of a mythology of England that I just do not think most people... beyond kind of like the rattling of the swords of the Second World War. Like, there's a quote that was clipped out from Douglas Murray, who was the keynote speaker, and he's like a right-wing kind of anti-Islam documenting the fall of the West writer who goes around the speaking circuit in Australia, New Zealand, US and the UK, where he said nationalism, but he basically goes, nationalism shouldn't have a bad rap because the Germans fucked it up twice in a century, which got a huge applause and is kind of funny. But then he gives this like lizard stare off into the crowd that just makes him look like Lord Voldemort. And those two things coupled together really are quite chilling.
I think he said the phrase mucked it up rather than fucked it up, but I suppose the meaning is much the same.
Of course. It, well, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's this weird nationalism that I don't think... Even the nationalism that I think about amongst, like, normal people is like, oh, yeah, I was sad when the Queen died, and I liked the pomp and ceremony of King Charles getting coronated. Aren't they lovely? Love tea and crumpets. Paddington Bear's cute. Come on, England. Blah, blah, blah. Mm. But even that sort of, like, nationalism is so divorced from kind of, like, the really extreme idea that these people have of what we should be like. Because I know so few people who are like any of these individuals, apart from the thinkers in the most privileged parts of the country, in Oxford and Cambridge and Durham University and all of those places, where it's a load of, like, smart people who want a load of power and see this as the best way of getting it. There you go, I said it. I said the quiet bit out loud, Jimmy.
Well, so the overriding philosophy behind this political movement, if you can call it that, because I think even most people involved in it would argue it's quite incoherent at the moment, it is the idea that it's kind of a defence of the nation state, I guess, and the idea that nation states should act in their interests, uh-huh. and it's a rejection of the, you know, the kind of universalizing ideas, or it's the somewheres versus the anywheres that David Goodhart outlined basically mm-hmm. in his book. So it taps into something that has been in the ether for the past decade or so, I think, and the kind of sense that globalization's been reversing and that countries have been looking out for themselves a lot more than they would have done at the turn of the century. I mean, I think countries have always looked out for themselves, but, you know, mm-hmm. they're doing it more overtly now than they used to, I think it's fair to say. I do get your point that I think that people who campaign about nationalism, I think, are much more into it than your average person. I think it's a little bit difficult to, because that expresses itself in different ways for different groups of people, right? Like, I think among the kinds of people you and me hang out with, it is seen as deeply weird. I mean, to sort of say something, I mean, there are some people in the conservative movement, including young people, that will say things like "God save the king," or like, yeah. Sincerely.
Yeah.
That happened
so
a lot when
weird.
It is. I find it very strange. I obviously partly say that as a Republican, but I think it's also just strange to hear that coming from somebody. I don't want to do this, you know, progressive cliche thing, but in 2023, it's very strange to hear people talking like that.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Particularly younger people, it's a little bit more understandable from older people. Mm. But I agree. I think that one of the big problems they will have, and to go back to the God thing, I think it was Miriam Cates, who is a fairly devout Christian and clearly thinks that this country should be a little bit more devout as well. But all of the surveys, I mean, I think, was it last year was the first year that we had more non-Christians than Christians, or a majority of non-religious people in this country?
Christians were a minority for the first time, I think. So it's, yeah. I think it's more non-Christians than Christians.
Yeah, I mean, the ship has sailed on that, basically. I mean, it's the only...
Yeah,
and
the desperation with which the pages of The Spectator especially are like, oh, yeah. I had one conversation with a young man about God, and that means that God is cool again. I'm not in. No.
Ironically, the only real growth in religious belief is coming from immigrant communities who, you know, people moving over from Africa or the Caribbean, yeah. or something like that, who tend to be much more religious than your average native British person. Mm-hmm. So that, I mean, that is one of the sort of amusing tensions, I guess, in this debate. That, and it one of the things that I guess all political movements are incoherent in their own ways, but I think this one is particularly incoherent at this stage. And I mean, I've read some commentaries from people who went to the first one and said that this one actually was felt as though things were maturing, and it was actually perhaps heading in.
It had a strong online presence, direction. Which I think was an interesting thing. Like, there are, we say that this is kind of like, and we talk about this being a philosophy and a viewpoint of maybe the older guard of conservatives, but I actually think this is the future of the Conservative Party. I think that if you are a young conservative, you are much more likely to be cut from this cloth than the cloth of like the Ken Clarks or Ruth Davidsons or Cameron or Osborne or any of those kinds of things. All of the people who are that way minded, who kind of just are a bit more pragmatic in the way that they want the country to work and less ideological, perhaps, they are not joined. Those young people are not joining the Conservative Party. Those who are joining the Conservative Party are the people who like to say God save the King, and the people who go to the posh gays who go to mass and all of that kind of group of people and have high tea to celebrate the King getting coronated. Like it's a load of oddballs, and I think, like it or not, this is what conservatism in this country is going to look like in the future, unless they do kind of like a big tack, because I mean they're certainly not winning over young people in the ways that they need to be able to have a grounding in the following decades, right?
I really need you to get back into YouTube documentary making and do Posh Gays Go to Mass as your next subject. I would 100% watch that.
I know exactly who I'd ask to be in it as well.
yeah, I mean, I think you're right about that. And I'd also say that generally, I think anyone who's looking at the Tory party over the last couple of years will have noticed that, I mean, the only people that are making big moves are people with, I don't want to say extreme views, some of them do have extreme views, but, you know, people who actually want to push it in a particular direction. There's nobody gunning for the status quo in the Tory party anymore. I don't think, like, Rishi Sunak looks like a kind of an isolated figure in his attempts to make, you know, present himself as a sensible custodian of the British government.
He was kind of doomed, isn't he? Because he's still dealing with Boris Johnson's Conservative Party. Like, it's...
Yeah, that was
two prime ministers ago.
And it is sort of weird that a party that is still in power is cracking up this much, I think. I know that parties that have been in office for a while, you know, different groups do emerge and there's always jostling for position, you know, as there is for parties outside of power. But it really, I mean, aside from the polling, it just really feels as though the Tory party is all over the place at the moment. And conferences like this that can be held with government ministers fairly openly criticising the government's direction. I mean, bearing in mind that Suella Braverman is the Home Secretary and therefore is an exceedingly important figure in that government.
I mean, it was just her speech really was just like, I'll be your next leader. Watch this space, essentially, wasn't it?
I guess so. I mean, I think most people who are even inclined towards her, you know, the right of the Tory party would prefer somebody like Kemi Badenoch to Suella Braverman.
She is more popular on Conservative Home, so they have the net satisfaction ratings of cabinet. Ben Wallace is still kind of like head and shoulders the most popular one, and Kemi Badenoch is number two on the list, just ahead of James Cleverly.
So Ben Wallace has actually indicated that he wants to be head of NATO when that job comes up again, which I think is relatively soon. He's currently Defence Secretary, so that's a fairly logical move.
And you know,
I think
that for once makes sense.
Obviously we've been watching the Tory party crack up for a while. It's been interesting to see it in conference form with the clips, you know, aired freely on the BBC website. That's a little bit different. It just feels like the Tories are pretty fucked at this point. And I guess that's probably a good thing. I think they've earned themselves some time on the bench.
I'm sorry, Jimmy. You say that like that just feels like the, like, oh, good job, lads. You've earned some time on the bench. And I just don't think, I just want to put this out there, Jimmy. I don't think that's the vibe.
No, I don't think that is the vibe, but, you know, anything to encourage them to step down for a little while and let somebody else have a go, I think.
A nice patronising pat. Speaking of letting somebody else have a go.
Yes.
Look at that. Great segue.
That was good. I mean, I thought we always ruin our good segues by pointing out that they're good.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Ronald DeSantis is currently... his middle name's Dion. Odd.
That's after a singer, I think.
Celine.
No, that would be good, but no. It's Dion McClellan or something. I read his Wikipedia page in preparation for the segment. It does say that. So anyone who's interested, you can Wikipedia Ron DeSantis and you'll find out.
Excellent. It's those little nuggets that are buried in the depths of somebody's Wikipedia page that people subscribe for. 100%.
I think so, yeah.
So DeSantis has been the governor of Florida for the last 4 years and has... from the very beginning, being tipped as a potential future leader for the Republican Party, and now has formally, after months and months of speculation, after a very public pandemic where he was anti-mask mandates, anti-lockdowns, and has picked a load of fights with quote-unquote wokishness and the Disney Corporation, who are the largest employer in his state. He, after having all of this attention, has decided, surprise, surprise, to throw his hat in the ring and say that he wants to be the next Republican candidate for president. He did so. So, I think most of the political commentary around his launch was point and laugh, ha ha ha, look how they fucked up on Twitter Spaces, why the hell are they doing that? But I think the interesting thing about this is the fact that he even decided to do it on Twitter Spaces with Elon, because I think it positions him as somebody who is trying to go for that libertarian, anti-woke, Joe Rogan, kind of like the shock jockey YouTube channel style of creator that has like a big audience. He wants to kind of like scoop that up by aligning himself with somebody like Elon Musk, where it's youthful. Elon Musk, I do think he's an idiot, but his followers are youthful and energetic, and it makes sense to me for DeSantis to align himself with somebody like Elon Musk. It went so badly and it was so embarrassing. But yeah,
I just can't believe that Joe Rogan's audience is going to swing the US presidential election. Like, surely there just aren't enough of them.
I'm thinking about it in terms of those absolute numbers of people who are watching, consuming that media. It is the influence that that space of the internet and that space of our culture then has as it permeates into the rest of society. So, though, despite what a lot of them say, those people who watch the Joe Rogan Show are families, girlfriends, friends, whatever, who they're then going to go and kind of like talk about how, well, DeSantis actually talks a lot of sense, really, and these are a really generally, I think, engaged, vocal group of people, albeit a minority. And I think it is, on paper, it was really smart to align himself like this. Unfortunately, Twitter Spaces doesn't work and crashes when you have 500,000 people on it, which is incredibly embarrassing for everybody involved. Ron DeSantis also has a problem in that he currently is only at about 20% of support among Republican Party members who would be voting for him in the primaries, which kick off later this year. Donald Trump already has an absolute majority. He already has over 50%.
Where's the rest of the votes going at the moment?
Most of it, well, 50% to Trump, 20% to DeSantis, and then like, oh, don't maybe Google, make me Google everybody else. Like Nikki Haley and all of those folks,
the also rans.
Yeah, exactly.
And when it comes to the primaries, because, as I understand it, you don't have to be a member of the Republican Party. You can register to vote in the Republican primary.
It depends, I think, state to state.
Ah, okay. Hmm. But generally, are these the sort of numbers you quoted, are they pretty indicative of how the result would go, or could there be a big swing when you factored in non-Republican Party members who would vote in that primary?
I mean, we're still... So, from my understanding, when they do these pollings, they factor in, generally, if it's a good poll, they're going to factor in that kind of stuff, like whether or not somebody actually has the right to vote in a and intends to vote in a Republican primary. I would be really surprised with a lead like this, even if the polling's all skew with. I mean, Donald Trump's going to sweep it, and there's even people who are suggesting that he's not even going to bother to campaign, really. Because if you already have over 50% of the vote in the polling, really, what is the point? The only way is down. And so I'd be really surprised if we really saw very much from Donald Trump, unless you ended up with the field of candidates still turning up to debates. That is going to inevitably happen because the news networks that host these debates really love the numbers that they bring in. And there's a load of drama with having a an unfilled podium, for example, where Donald Trump refuses to stand, refuses to turn up to those events. And so it is possible that momentum could be built for a candidate like DeSantis. 30 points is huge.
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
And from Trump's point of view, not turning up and being, I forget what the word is, but having a podium thrown up where he should be, according to the news media, I mean, that still feeds into his fairly antagonistic narrative about his relationship to the media, doesn't it? So I don't know that that's necessarily a problem for him in the way it would be for a different type of candidate.
Yeah, I think I'd probably agree. I don't think Ron DeSantis, he has been seen as kind of like the person probably best positioned to take over from the Donald Trump baton in terms of where he's aligned. He used to be a Donald Trump supporter back in the day. And I just do not think he has the charismatic chops to be able to do a proper run for the presidency.
Well, I've seen his campaign launch video, which was put out at the same time as the Twitter Spaces thing.
It was pretty cool. It was a pretty good video, don't you think?
Did we see the same video?
It was like, I didn't like anything in it, but I thought it was like good words and well produced.
Is this the one of him sort of standing in front of a flag and then he goes through a black curtain and then comes out and then just says, "Oh, I'm running for president"?
No, I'm thinking about another one.
You're thinking of a different video. Okay, maybe the one you saw was a lot more impressive, but the one I saw was...
Mine had loads of editing.
Right. Okay.
But yeah, he doesn't have... He's not very... Like, you see Donald Trump in front of crowds. Like, it's like going to a rock concert. Watching DeSantis speak is not like going to a rock concert.
That is true of most politicians, though. I would say... If his shtick is like Trumpism without Trump, which I think is the phrase that's gone around him, then part of that has to be not being... as charismatic, basically, being a lower key presence in terms of political rallies and that sort of thing.
But then you're not the Trump without the Trump. You're not Trump without the Trump. Do you know what I mean?
But I think Trumpism without Trump, like the philosophy without the madman in charge of it.
How many people do you think voted for Donald Trump based on philosophy?
Well, a certain amount of stick it to the man. I appreciate by most factors Donald Trump is the man, but put that to one side.
The apple cart vibes.
Donald Trump is an anti-establishment figure in as much as the he was president at one stage, so I think where you can make different definitions about this, but he's not part of the cultural elite because he's seen as a joke and always has been. And this was part of his appeal to a lot of people, I think, was that it genuinely was a vote against the sort of people that run the United States of America. And we have similar things, similar sentiments over here at times. I suppose that maybe is DeSantis's problem, is that if he doesn't tap into those same emotions on a visceral level, maybe Trumpism has to have Trump. Maybe you can't, that is the appeal of Trump is the appeal of Trumpism. And without the person, you don't really have anything. So maybe you're right in that sense.
Yeah, we'll see. I think it certainly turns into something else because there are so many people that have stapled their colours to that flag of Trumpism and rely on his success in order to succeed. Not least, like a ton of people who won their seats while he was president. DeSantis being one of them, actually. But I don't, like, I don't think Ivanka Trump seems to be the kind of person who's actually going to take over from him. I don't think Donald Trump Jr. is going to take over from his dad. And I don't know who gets anointed afterwards. I think whatever comes next has to be something else. And I think that there is, as long as Donald Trump is still in the game, I think we've seen the limitations of aligning yourself with him. Because as long as he's there, how are you going to out-Trump Trump? You can. But being aligned with Trump is the only way to be able to win anything with people who are aligned with the Republican Party in the United States at the moment. And so as long as he's running for stuff, you may as well, I don't know, kowtow to him and say yes and hope that you get a vice presidential nod.
Yeah, or you know, end up governor of the state and that being enough for you. But I guess the sort of people who run to be governors of states often have, you know, further aspirations beyond that. So, you know, it sounds as though Ron DeSantis did pretty well running under the banner of Trump. And this, I'm not really seeing, because some of this polling was available on his chances of actually getting the Republican tickets. The polling was available before he made his announcement. Is it not conceivable that he could have not announced and not actually run this time and said, oh, you know, those were just rumors?
DeSantis?
DeSantis.
I feel like it's so easy for your moment to pass.
Mm.
I think he had to run this time for fear of that opportunity passing him by.
Yeah,
because
that makes
sense,
actually.
I think you've seen that with people like Chris Christie, who was the governor of New Jersey. And
is this the guy that was caught up in like a crack scandal, or was that someone else I'm thinking of?
Have I just
libeled the former governor?
No.
Of New Jersey?
But he ended up having to be Donald Trump's bitch really during the presidential race, because his moment had passed, really, his political moment and chance had passed. And I think that is, in America, when your brand is the most important thing, I think that is, like, you have to take that opportunity. It's like, if you watch Drag Race, it's like getting the call back to All Stars. You can't turn it down because you don't know if they're never going to call you, you know?
I like that analogy you've just used. It's very on brand. I should clarify that Chris Christie, as far as I'm aware, has not been involved in crack use allegations.
Did you just Google Chris Christie crack?
No, I just looked up his Wikipedia.
Okay.
He was involved in this weird bridge scandal, which
I do remember
reading about.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that part of my memory is clearly working fine. But it's too complicated a scandal for me to go into, largely because I only vaguely remember it. I guess we're going to be covering this quite a lot over the next, our America correspondent. We're going to be covering. So when does the actual election take place again? Is it the end of 2024?
In November 2024, yes.
November 2024. So we've got quite a long run up to this.
Mm-hmm.
But we already, you know, it sounds like we already have the two candidates. It's another Biden-Trump race, so.
Lovely.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, almost.
Unless that anti-vaxxer really wins the Democratic thing, that would be fun.
You're talking about
Kelly.
Bobby Kennedy.
Yeah, Kennedy, not Kelly.
Kennedy, yeah. God, what a crazy country America is, you know.
Why am I here?
I thought there's a bonus segment there somewhere, but maybe next time. Shall we talk about ADHD, you know, changing subject rapidly?
Yeah, I've actually, that was quite good. I've kind of given my viewpoint. How have you interpreted this? I feel like there's a little smugness in your understanding of where we are with of this investigation that the BBC did around ADHD and diagnosis.
Smugness in what way?
Maybe I'm projecting, but I get the impression that you're like, well, all of these people on TikTok are self-diagnosing themselves, and of course they weren't going to be correct.
So there is this phenomenon which is not just happening with ADHD. I should say I don't use TikTok, so this is all based on stuff I've read.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it is fair to say that there's a culture on social media of people really embracing a particular medical, you know, mental health diagnosis or learning disability diagnosis, and it becoming part of their personal brand in some instances, or at least it becoming
not necessarily a key brand, part of, I think, but like a key way that they understand their how they move through the world, I think.
Yes, and also a key way of how they present themselves to the world, at least as far as social media goes, and sometimes that spills over into real life as well. I mean, I'm not so much smug about this investigation. I think it it does speak, you know, the superficial reading of this, which is that some of these clinics that offer ADHD diagnoses are not being as rigorous with the testing process as you would get in the NHS. I mean, I totally buy that. I think that is probably true.
And I think that's definitely true because they have an incentive to give you drugs because they get
commercial
more money.
Incentive, yeah.
It's the same as anything that we do that I do in the US. My dentist spent about 45 minutes trying to sell me Invisalign the other day.
Okay. Did you take it?
No. It's my teeth are fine.
Might have been quicker just to accept it. He might have let you out after 15 minutes.
Right. But it's like the thing of actually in a purely private system, very often there are incentives for practitioners to have you go through with some kind of treatment that you don't necessarily need, and maybe there are cheaper ways for you to be able to address this disease or phenomena that you are going through or diagnosis that you have.
Well, I mean, equally, you could argue in a public healthcare system such as the NHS, there is also a bit, there's a phrase I heard when I was writing about social care, which is demand management, which is the idea that consultants will push. It's a cross-cutting measure, basically, that you encourage people to self-treat where possible. In many ways, it's a sensible way of actually, if you've got scarce resources, it's a sensible way of trying to allocate those to people that will benefit from them the most, and to try and get people to, help themselves where possible. But I feel also it does kind of create an incentive in certain ways not to give people, you know, where there's cusp cases, I suppose, there may be an incentive not to actually offer people certain treatment where you're not sure that they get a benefit from it. Do you see what I'm saying? It can kind of go the other way in a public healthcare system. But I mean, it also does speak to the fact that there are really long waiting lists to getting an assessment of a mental health problem or learning difficulty in the NHS. This was something that the BBC did actually acknowledge, is that part of the reason these services have sprung up, and it costs a couple of hundred quid for an assessment. I think it was like £500 was the figure quoted for some of the assessments the BBC reporter went through. I do think it does speak to the strains that the NHS is under. But as I said, I buy the general thesis, but I also think that you're probably right that part of it is simply that there's certainly more awareness around the, you know, ADHD specifically, and you know, the wider spectrum of conditions in general. So there are people who previously would never have thought to actually go and seek help of any sort for things that they were experiencing, you know, psychological things and mental things, that are now doing so. And I think that is part of that. That is a factor in all of this. Did you read about much of the backlash against this documentary?
No. Can you give me the 411 of it? Because I actually didn't get to watch it because it's geo-blocked for me because it's in the BBC.
Okay, I didn't watch it because I don't have the time.
Oh, but
a rough summary of it is
excellent.
That,
we're doing a review of a documentary that neither of us have watched. I have read the piece around it. The investigation.
They presented it as a news report as well, and I think it is fair to react to a news report.
Yeah.
The BBC has put out, but there is a full documentary available for those who are interested. So one of the criticisms was that well people in general felt that the documentary was fodder to people who don't think that ADHD is a real thing.
Yeah.
I can see why they said that, but I think that, as with a lot of these things, it sort of, you sort of get to the stage where anybody who's expressing any skepticism about some aspect of phenomenon is then criticized because people feel that it casts doubt over,
I don't know. I have that immediate visceral reaction to it because and you see it for other diagnoses as well, like dyslexia, which I also have. It's so boring seeing people continue to say that it isn't real and that it's like a snowflake thing. But I can't read properly. it objectively takes me like twice as long to read anything for anyone that I've ever met. And to have I actually don't like the word diagnosis because it kind of like pathologizes it a little bit. I understand it for me anyway, and this is very specifically for my understanding of like how my brain works. It just allows me to understand how my brain works and how I can allow it to work better. Like it has given me techniques and ways of interacting with the world that mean that I can continue to be like productive and good at my job and do well at school and all of those kind of things that I wasn't able to do properly before I had all of those tools that were made available to me through being diagnosed with dyslexia and ADHD. And so I also have, because the diagnosis that I had was so, it really did kind of like completely transform my life. Like I was going from C's in academia to after getting the help that I needed, going to A's and A stars, and that completely changed the trajectory of my life. And so I also get very defensive about the fact that people stand up in Parliament still and say and suggest that dyslexia is made up, and it's actually just people are lazy and don't want to concentrate. And I'm like, oh, stop being boring.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously there have been. I think some people have used this documentary. You know, some people will use this documentary to express that.
Yeah, and now I'm going to have to deal with people who cite this. I think the report I think is good, and this is a good investigation. And it sounds to me like it is too easy to get really strong drugs, and drugs that have like side effects and consequences. It's become very, very easy to get that, it looks like.
I think that is part of the top line here, I think most people, even people who are, you know, express the fear that you've expressed that this is fodder for people who are skeptical that these conditions even exist. Mm-hmm. You know, there are other consequences here that do have to be thought of. And I think what I was saying is that there will always be people who treat any skepticism as though it's, you know, it's universal skepticism rather than skepticism about one thing in particular. I don't think this BBC documentary, I mean, I think part of the premise for this BBC documentary is ADHD is real and therefore some people don't have it who may be misdiagnosed as having it. Mm-hmm. Like that is one of the things that has to be implicit for this documentary to make any sense at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, part of this is just people reacting in stupid ways to things on the internet, so
sure,
you know, that does happen. I think the other thing that was raised, which I'm sure you'll have an opinion on, is that
me an opinion, but I'm so sure.
is that basically some people felt that it's about the concept that people should have to struggle or to have to jump through hoops in order to get a, you said you don't like the word diagnosis, but you know, in this case
I then went on to use it about a dozen times, but yeah, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, so some people, I mean, some people say that it actually shouldn't be that difficult to get an ADHD diagnosis, basically. So they didn't have a problem with it being fairly readily obtainable based on like a half hour consultation over the phone with a doctor.
Yeah,
so that was the other criticism that came through.
Yeah, I mean, the experience that I have had is because I went through, this was over 15, oh my God, it's nearly 20 years ago. I'm so old. Sorry, I just had a moment. It was over 20 years ago that I got my assessment, and it is the long kind of like, really deep, and like they went through school reports and talked to teachers and all of those kinds of things, and That has meant that whenever I've gone to a new doctor, they have always taken those diagnoses and gone to a new institution or whatever. They've taken them seriously, rather than having to go through the situation again, like doing a telecall or whatever. But also, it's incredibly expensive for the NHS to diagnose me in that way.
Yeah.
Like, it's a lot of labor and expertise to go through it. And, like, maybe the diagnosis should be easy, but I don't know. Drugs can be life-changing for people, but I am still... I genuinely think that drugs should be tried after you've tried kind of, like, all of the other things. Is, like, how I approach stuff. I know it doesn't work for everybody, but that is the thing that I find... worrying about this, because it just sounds like people are bribing people to get Adderall, essentially, but it's a private it's a private practice.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, what you said is actually another of the criticisms that fed in, is that the BBC reporter, when he went to the NHS, he was actually fast-tracked to, I think it was the leading ADHD specialist within the NHS, or certainly one of the top ones. And yeah, as he was given this long, I think it was a 3-hour assessment, and they went through loads of his backstory and various things that happened to him.
I didn't quite have the psychological like deep dive that he did. Like, he had to talk about trauma that he had as a kid. Mine wasn't quite that much.
And as you say, you know, given that the NHS massively struggles with you know, mental health, waiting lists anyway, that's not something that's likely to change. And you know, I think given that. There's an increased awareness of these kind of conditions, and there's an increased demand for mental health services in general. That's unlikely to change anytime soon. I think some of the criticisms of the investigation were valid, but I think the gist of it seemed reasonable to me, basically, as an observer.
Yeah, understood. Right. I think that's quite enough.
Should we wrap
it
off there? I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
I think
okay,
so.
Cool. We're going to talk about giving Jimmy a vasectomy in the bonus segment on the Patreon. So if you want to hear that, then you can give us some money.
Yeah, you've got to pay for that premium content where we talk about making me infertile.
Finally. I'm just glad it's on the cards, you know. It should be on the table.
I'm just glad we've opened this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Good.
All right. Bye-bye to everyone else.
Toodaloo.